Well, hello. It is good to see you all again. Let me start by saying thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you to our staff and vestry and ministry leaders and Daryl for preaching and everyone who has continued to keep this beautiful place going for these last 3 weeks. I appreciate it so much, and I'm so very grateful. I've had a wonderful time away with my family, and I come back rested and refreshed and ready to go. Watch out! I've been both happy to have been able to step away for a bit and eager to return to the ministry that we share. In fact, in just 2 weeks, we will be celebrating our one-year anniversary. I wonder what we'll get each other. Today is the last of what we could describe as a four-part mini-series on bread. Over the last 4 weeks, our gospel lessons have come from the sixth chapter of the Gospel of John and have focused almost exclusively on Jesus' insistence that he is the bread of life. Well, from the beginning, four things seem abundantly clear. First, this teaching is important in our faith. Second, this teaching was hard for Jesus' followers. Third, this teaching is probably hard for us now as well. And fourth, this is the gospel, so there's got to be some good news. So let's look at each of those four aspects. First, that this teaching is important. Bread, as a metaphor for the gift Jesus came to offer, is central throughout this entire sixth chapter of the Gospel of John. Again and again, we hear Jesus trying to share this way of thinking. It must have also been important to our religious ancestors who determined our weekly scripture readings called our Sunday lectionary. Not only did they put together this little four-part mini-series of readings with the same theme week after week after week, but they did so in such a way that certain key verses are repeated one week to another. I just realized this week, as I went back and read all four Gospels, it seems more than just interesting that the ending of each of the past weeks then begins the gospel reading of the next week, creating kind of a subliminal underscoring, perhaps, of the importance of those passages. So, just in case you haven't memorized those, let's recap. What are those three passages that over the last 4 weeks, people who have been in church consistently, where they've had services consistently, albeit, I understand, this is what has been heard three times each of these 4 weeks. At the end of August 5th and then again at the beginning of August 12th, Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." Then ending August 12th and beginning August 19th, Jesus said, "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats of this bread will live forever, and the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh." And then, ending August 19th and beginning today, August 26th, Jesus said, "Those who eat my flesh and drink my blood abide in me and I in them. Just as the living Father sent me and I live because of the Father, so whoever eats me will live because of me. This is the bread that came down from heaven, not like that which was your ancestors ate and they died, but the one who eats this bread will live forever." So regardless of what we think or how we may react to these maybe difficult words, like it or not, these readings are here and beg our attention. This teaching that Jesus is the bread of life is clearly important to wrestle with and find a way somehow to meaningfully weave into our faith journey. Next, it seems that as important as this bread of life theme was, and maybe is still, It was really hard back in the day for Jesus to communicate this. In fact, today we hear in this gospel that it was so hard, so offensive, so disturbing that all but Peter and a few disciples actually stayed while the rest turned back and no longer followed Jesus. Remember, what Jesus was suggesting through the words, "Eat my flesh and drink my blood," were in direct opposition to Jewish law and the mandates of Hebrew scripture. To those hearing that suggestion, they would not only have been understandably repulsed, perhaps, by the notion of eating flesh and drinking blood, but also fearful that doing so would be a direct violation of Hebrew scripture and Jewish law. So even as symbolic language, referring to the actual bread and wine, not literal flesh and blood, this would have been an unacceptable suggestion to the most faithful. So no wonder the majority of them turned away and decided not to follow this weird guy. Third, point three, this was hard for us to hear as well, I suspect. Are we really that different? Isn't it a hard proposition for us to wrap our heads around, eating flesh and drinking blood? Now really, have you ever had a conversation with someone trying to explain the Eucharist? Have you tried to articulate how and why eating bread and drinking wine as symbols of the love of God makes a difference in your life? It's not an easy thing to explain in an empirically satisfying way, right? And beyond that, John seems to make it even harder in my book, as he is the one gospel writer of all four that takes this teaching about the bread of life to a new, even grittier level. He is the one that actually uses, some might say, a gory description of actually incorporating words like flesh and blood. If John is like the gospel writer who wants us to fall in love in Jesus, is this a good idea? Truly, I could do without the words, I'll just say, eat my flesh and drink my blood. I hear those words and I just want to say, yuck! Did I just say that in church? Yeah, I did. But here's the thing. Underscored and emphasized and repeated, not only in scripture, are these words all over our liturgies, in our prayers, in our songs, and most emphatically, in our regular practice of the celebration of the Eucharist every week at this table. Since 1979, the new edition of our Book of Common Prayer in the Episcopal Church has moved from having communion, celebrating and offering the bread and the wine, from once a month to every week. The move underscores our belief that week in and week out, in the midst of our all too hectic and the haziness of our lives, we believe it's incredibly helpful to gather together as church and to count on having elements of bread and wine lifted in the air that we might possibly see and taste God's particular promises of acceptance and forgiveness and mercy and love. And as hard as it is to completely make sense of it, we cling to the pattern and the promises of the Eucharist, hoping to receive what we need each time we put out our hands and receive the bread and then drink from the cup. So why is the act of receiving the bread so important to us? And what does it really mean? Well, I've come to believe that the answer to that question evolves. It evolves and changes for each of us as our relationship to the divine evolves. But here's my answer at 10:25. Communion, the act of receiving the blessed bread and wine, is the act of taking the simple, common, and ordinary elements of water, bread, and wine, the very stuff of everyday life, and using them to point us to a deeper truth. And I believe that truth is lodged somewhere in the notion that Jesus, the cosmic expression of God's eternal love, is indeed the bread of life. Daryl gave us another answer to that question in his sermon on August 5th. I don't know if he's ever been quoted before, but I would like to quote. Daryl said, "The Eucharist isn't magic. It is ordinary eating and drinking being lifted up as a sign of the extraordinary nature of all of life. What we're doing here is practicing. We are working out our incarnation muscles. We gather each week to recognize and celebrate that Christ is present in this meal so that we will be empowered to recognize and celebrate that Christ is present in every meal. Receiving this now, we learn to receive every moment of every day as a gift." Thank you, my brother. It's complicated and hard to wrap our heads and hearts around all of it, but I continue to believe it is indeed worthy to try. And to be sure, there are days when I'm so very grateful that none of us have to have this whole Eucharist thing figured out in order to come to this table and to receive what is being offered, a table of love that we set and offer week after week. So now number four, we turn this final corner and try to parse out some good news of all of this. With all the difficulty of this teaching, all of the maybe somewhat offensive words, Jesus is the bread of life, the flesh and the blood, and what it all really means, what could possibly make us stay as Peter did, rather than simply turning around and going off with the masses and not following Jesus? I read a wonderful insight this week by another preacher describing what Peter might have been thinking and feeling and maybe why he stayed. I want to read it to us as I think it captures a depth of meaning that might help us think about why we stay. Peter is as offended as anyone else by what Jesus is saying. "Of all the disciples, you remember that Peter is the one who stands up for traditional faith. Peter keeps the dietary laws. He never eats forbidden things, including any kind of meat with the blood still in it. So the idea of gnawing flesh and drinking blood must turn his stomach as badly as it does anyone else's. But where is he to go? As confusing as Jesus is, Peter has glimpsed something in Jesus that he cannot turn away from. He has glimpsed God. And if trusting that means struggling with a whole lot of distasteful things that go with it, then Peter will consent to struggle. He will not give up the truth he has found, even if it comes tucked full in a box of spiders. He will not go away from the life he has been led to, even if it is miles away from the life he thought he wanted." I love that description. It resonates with me. Maybe it does you too. You see, it does for me because even in the moments of inexplicable absurdity or contradiction or confusion, I find myself staying put here rather than walking away. This is a hard gospel lesson to hear. The words can indeed be not only confusing, but in fact downright offensive. We are no different, it seems, as many of the disciples who rejected what Jesus was trying to offer. Some of us leave church on a regular basis. You're supposed to chuckle there. Some will stay no matter what. And still others from our wider community may never trust that there is anything worth checking out within these walls. So at the end of the day, with all of these kinds of hard teachings, along with the inevitable politics and challenges of living close next to each other in a community of faith, why do we stay? Why are we here? Why do we bother? I've actually thought a lot about that, especially in these 3 weeks where I stepped away and had a little distance to think about us here. And my answer today is a version of Simon Peter's answer as well. My answer is simply this. Where else can we go? Where else can we go to see a glimpse of a preferred future? Where else can we go to find a vastly diverse community of those who we may never otherwise cross paths with? Where else can we go to kiss newborns and welcome the stranger and listen to the stories about addiction and recovery and despair and triumph? Where can we go to respect our elders, to celebrate and grieve at the time of death? Where can we go to hold each other as we laugh and as we cry and as we talk about the things that are deep within our hearts and really matter? Where else can we go to be with people when the rest of the world feels like it's too much to bear? Where else can we go to feed our hungry souls when they feel malnourished and void of the depth or purpose of connection? Where else can we go with all the flaws and missteps, with all the uncertainty and misunderstandings that obviously will happen? Well, the place that I need to go is here. I need to go here. Because you see, here is where you are. Those who are willing to claim that they are both broken and blessed, flawed and called, those who will help me understand how to follow Jesus, even when his words offend or don't make sense to me. Where else can we go? My answer has become here. Even amidst the challenges, it is here that I am drawn to try to make deeper meaning and purpose, and to surrender to a way of life that is not predicated on whether I agree or disagree with some faith proposition. Where I want to be is here. And sometimes the commitment is simply to be doggedly determined to just keep showing up. And through that showing up, just maybe, we too will glimpse God amidst our own box of spiders, because we do have a big old box of spiders. I underscore that because I hate spiders. And I love that idea, because if somewhere tucked in that box of spiders is the reality that I am both beloved and able to love, then it's worth holding on to that box. So here I stand, asking you to stay standing with me as we invite others to come alongside of us as well, because this is a journey that we cannot take alone. So thank you today for making the decision to stay, at least for today. I understand that all too well that this may be a temporary status for some of you. Church always seems to be one Sunday away from either offending or attracting someone else. But here's the thing. The gospel way, the way of Jesus, the way of this preferred future, seems to get that in spades. And Scripture seems to imply, God's got this. That we don't have to worry about. And here then, as we come to the end, is the really, really good news. Whether we are confused or offended, here for the duration or just passing through, comfortable with our traditions or new to this whole way of doing church, all of us are truly welcome and wanted just as we are. Our job is to keep showing up and welcoming others to do the same. Even when we are confused or pissed or lonely or in need of no one else at all, thank you very much, we are still welcome and wanted. The good news, as my brother Daryl said, is that every time we gather for the Eucharist, we get to practice by putting out our hands and opening our mouths week after week, trusting that we will be fed in the ways that we need. and empowered to walk the way of love, the way of Jesus. Even on the days that we don't agree or don't understand or feel offended in any number of ways. I end this morning with a poem by Anglican priest and singer, songwriter, and poet Malcolm Gweet. I hope that it will gather our hearts and move us beyond the need to always worry about whether we agree or disagree, letting us simply rest for a moment in the beauty and the mystery that just maybe, once again, we will come to this table of love set for us in just a few minutes so that our hungry souls will be fed by the bread of life. Where to get bread? Where to get bread? An ever-pressing question that trembles on the lips of anxious mothers. Bread for their families, bread for all these others, a whole world on the margin of exhaustion. And where that hunger has been satisfied, where to get bread? The question still returns. In our abundance, something starves and yearns. We crave fulfillment, crave, and are often denied. And then comes one who speaks into our needs, who opens out the secret hopes we cherish, whose presence calls our hidden hearts to flourish, whose words unfold in us like living seeds. Come to me, broken, hungry, incomplete, for I am the bread of life. Break this bread of which I speak. Eat of this love which I offer. It's good to be home, my friends. May it be so.